Yes, good evening from me. My name is Suri Gupta, and I'm going to be continuing the seminar series we've been having on a practice that we do called the Sevenfold Puja. So I'm just going to check, firstly, how many of you have done the Sevenfold Puja, done it as a practice, okay? And how many of you were here last week as well, where we also talked about it? Okay, so great, lovely. So I will say a bit about the practice, because a few of you haven't done it before. So basically, since January, Jnanavacha and I have been exploring themes arising from this practice. And you'll be familiar with the mindfulness of breathing, the metta-bhavana practice, and the puja. Puja means worship, and it's a collective devotional practice which involves a series of verses that we say in call and response and chanting. So we won't do the puja tonight, but probably in a couple of weeks' time we'll have a go together actually doing the practice. But really we've been exploring the themes that arise from it, because these seven verses from the puja are really, you could say, they really outline a whole sort of spiritual path, a whole way of practicing. In a way, what's said about the puja, it's the way that a spiritually advanced person expresses themselves in their lives. And the seven verses are seven ways, if you like, they express themselves. They're seven qualities, seven moods, seven sort of ways of being, really, that a spiritually advanced person would just naturally be. So when we do the puja, when we practice and we say the verses, these seven verses, or seven phases of the puja, we get a sort of taste of the way a spiritually advanced person thinks, the way they behave, the way they see the world, the way they interact. We get a sort of taste of that. And we also, we get a taste of it, but also we get a sense of, well, we connect with it, we connect with those themes, and so that we can engage sort of fully in the practice, but also so we can take the reflections that we have outside of the practice and begin to explore ways that we also can sort of practice these ways too. So the practice itself engages all of ourselves. We're chanting, we might bow, we might offer candles, we use our minds, we might visualize some of the things that are said in the verses. So we engage all of ourselves, body, speech and mind. And that also helps us engage all of our energies as well. I often think that we don't use half the amount of energy that we have. I feel like we sit on a lot of energy. In a way, the practice, the puja, is there to really help us galvanize much of our energies. But galvanize our energies in a direction that's really positive, in a direction towards our ideals. So what I'm going to do is I'll run through some of the themes, so you get a sense of the practice, and then pick up today's new theme as well. So the first stage is called worship. So what we're doing in that first stage is we're really beginning to identify what our values are, what really matters to us, what makes life meaningful, worthwhile. And for us as Buddhists, that's sort of expressed in the ideal of the Buddha. The ideal of the Buddha who represents freedom, the possibility of freedom for our lives. The possibility is Manjusir was saying out there, the possibility that actually we can find fulfillment in actually really knowing our minds, really knowing my minds, really knowing our hearts. So that's the first stage, really beginning to identify our values. And if you're fairly new to practice, I remember when I was fairly new to practice, I was beginning to differentiate, well, what is Buddhist values and what are the values that I've been living with? what's the values, what's Buddhist values, and what's the values that I'm around in the world? What's the values that are being expressed when I open the newspaper, when I read, when I watch the TV? What are these values? I was beginning to begin to see differences between what I was discovering here at the Buddhist Centre and what I was around. And then beginning to wanting to move in a certain direction. So that is worship, where you begin to ascertain and identify what really matters, what's going to help you be free, what's going to help you sort of connect with who you really are, your potential. We say that our potential is to sort of live freely without greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's the first stage. The second stage in the puja is called salutation. And in this stage, in a way, you've identified your values. You think, actually, it is possible to live a life that's free, that's positive, that's loving. It is possible to live that. But in a way, that sort of ideal can sort of really disappear from us. We can catch hold of it, and then by the end of our day, we're back to not really being clear what it is, what's different about sort of Buddhist values, if you like. So in the salutation, what we're doing there, we're sort of affirming the values. We've identified them, and then we need to affirm them. And the ways we do that as Buddhists is, we often recommend, if you've gone on retreat, for example, you've done a meditation course, to have something in your house, if you like, that reminds you of your values, like a shrine. And it might be, you might have a picture of a Buddha there, or an image of a Buddha, but you also just might have something beautiful there that reminds you of the possibility of beauty. And then you want to, when you feel connected to your values, you often want to express that. And that's why you'll see Buddhists bowing, for example, because you want to express what you're feeling inside. It's not enough just to sit there and go, yes, I want to be free. That has to find expression somehow. So yes, you may sort of bow, you may light a candle, you may light an incense. When I'm out in nature, I want to sometimes, if I really feel, you know, connected to a tree, you know, that's representing a value, that represents beauty. Sometimes I just might want to touch it, just to feel that connection. We want to express what's inside. We also, in that section, recognise that, well, our values are here. We want freedom, we want connection, we want love, we want truth. But we're here. We're not near our values at that point. So in a way, by expressing it, by affirming our values, we sort of recognise a distance, but we also set in that intention to move towards our values more. So that's the second stage. And then, well, you know your values, you've worked out what they are, you've worked out why they're important, you sort of are expressing that, you're affirming that somehow to yourself. And the third stage is called the going for refuge section in the puja. And in this going for refuge section, we're basically saying, okay, I know my values, they're important to me, they make a difference, but I need to act on them. I need to do something about them. One needs to commit oneself to going in that direction. And that's what the going for refuge section is. It's a commitment to going in a certain direction. And when we commit ourselves, in a way, it does need to, again, find expression. And in this section, and we did it earlier in the meditation, we chanted the ethical precepts. So a really practical way to go in the direction of your values, Buddhist values, is to practice the precepts, is to recognise what of your behaviour leads to well-being and happiness and contentment, and which of your behaviours actually leads to more craving, more anger, frustration. And then takes decisions about what behaviours you're going to try and refrain from, and which behaviours you're going to try and cultivate more of. And that's what the precepts do. We have a set of negative precepts, which are about things we want to refrain from, things we know cause us harm, cause other people harm. and things that we know creates contentment and well-being and fulfillment for us. Those are the positive precepts. So we're chanting that in that stage of the puja. And so that's the third stage. And there's seven stages, and I've just done three. And what I would say is that you can do all this in the course of a day. You could imagine waking up in the morning and deciding, and just bring into mind what matters to you, bring into mind your values. First thing in the morning, rather than going on your phone, which is a temptation, I know, you could bring to mind, whether it's an image or a feeling of what matters, yes? And you could, again, light a candle or do something to express that. And that could all be done before breakfast. And then you're going out to your day, you're going out to whatever activities you're engaged in, and that's where you can begin to think about our actions, our behaviours. So which behaviours that you're impacted by others, but also that you do, that leaves you feeling expansive, leaves you feeling calm, leaves you feeling relaxed. You'll actually see that straight away. We have an instant feedback. Yes, if somebody smiles at us, we often want to smile back or we feel good. If somebody's critical to us, that has an immediate effect. And of course, we get that feedback when we act a certain way as well. So in this stage, you've got the chance to really understand what's your mental states and the effect they're having in the world, both positively and negatively, and do something about that. So that's the third stage. And in a way, these next three stages, the going for refuge section and the next stage, which is called confession, what happens when you realise you've got certain kinds of behaviours that actually you trip yourself up each time, yes? How many of you sort of will have something that you know actually you keep doing, it doesn't serve you, doesn't help you, actually causes you discomfort, pain, suffering, but you still do it. Just a show of hands. Are we brave enough to show our hands? Yeah, okay. So that's most of us. And the converse is true, yes? But with confession, you're really getting to know yourself here. You're meditating. You'll be chanting, you'll be engaged in puja, perhaps collectively, and you're beginning to get to know your mind and begin to get to know the mental states that don't serve you. So in this section, you get a chance to let them go, to actually understand them, understand what drives them, understand all the conditions that have helped create them, and then let them go. From a Buddhist perspective, those negative mind states, unskillful sort of behaviours, are not who we are. Who we are, Buddhism says in a way that our mind, our hearts, are intrinsically pure, intrinsically loving, intrinsically clear. It's like the vast blue sky. It's just radiant. That is the natural, the nature of mind, radiant and loving. That in a way, it's if you could imagine the infinite blue sky, but it's got the kind of a very warm sun. Yes, that's that's the love. That's the sort of radiance of love expressing itself. That is who we are. That's how our minds and hearts are. But then we have these clouds. We have these very thick clouds that come and will obscure all of that radiance to the point where you forget that there was ever even a blue sky there. And we have that in the winter, don't we? There's this really thick cloud and you forget that a few months ago we were sort of sweltering in the heat, yes? You just completely forget that because you've become really accustomed to the heavy clouds. So in the confession section, in this fourth section, we are, we're coming to terms with the fact that we're not always as good as we think we are, actually. We get competitive, we're envious, we get angry, frustrated, we're very mindless sometimes around our actions, we're very quite selfish beings in some many ways. But those are the clouds, those are the sort of thick obscurations, if you like, that's actually stopping us from connecting with our truest self, our truest potential, which is the radiant sky. So in confession, what we're doing is recognising that there are clouds there, recognising there's unskillful negative states there, and understanding them and letting them go. We're not over-identifying with them. We're not saying, well, that's me. I'm just an angry person. I'm just selfish. That's who I am. We're seeing that as a condition that's just preventing us from seeing who we really are. And we let it go in the confession section. So there's no guilt in Buddhism. In a way, there's nothing to feel guilty for. We can feel remorseful for sometimes when we hurt ourselves or other people. We feel the pain of that. But again, if you remember the vision, the possibility of freedom, that helps you let those things go. So that's our fourth stage. And then our fifth stage, which we covered last week, so we're coming right up to date now, is the rejoicing section. So having really understood sort of our negative conditioning, our negative traits, our habits that really sort of get in our way, and learning to let them go, we feel a bit freer. We feel a bit more, well, we're certainly more aware of ourselves. We understand ourselves a bit more. We feel a bit freer. And we recognize how that growth is not an easy task. Yeah, we recognize it's not easy to change a habit. It's not easy to change a negative habit, even when you really, really want to. But when you do, when you begin to see those clouds dissipate, it's such a relief, and it gives you sort of a sense of freedom. And then you begin to look around and really appreciate other people's positive qualities. You begin to appreciate positivity in others. And that's this section where you can rejoice in the qualities and skills of other people. In a way, when you're doing that, you're sort of recognising the individual person, but you're really recognising the importance of growth in the world. You're saying, actually, I know how hard it is to grow. I've sort of worked on myself a bit now. I know how hard it is to grow. So when I see positivity in others, I can really, rejoice in that. I can really say, yes, you've gone further than me, or you're showing me a quality that I'm yet to manifest. But the fact that you're showing me that quality shows it's possible for me as well. So at the weekend, my sister rejoiced in my qualities, my merits, and she would, by her own admission, would say that she's quite a critical person. By her own admission, she says she tells it like it is, doesn't take prisoners, she just tells you what she thinks. So it was amazing hearing her rejoice in my merits. I thought, oh, here we go, what's she going to say? And she actually took quite a bit of time to really break down all this. I mean, I'd done something that she really thought was very good, and she broke down exactly what she appreciated about what I'd done and what effect she thought it would have. And she just didn't hold back. And it was just fantastic. I mean, I was a sort of the object, if you like, of her rejoicings, but actually what I was doing was enjoying her rejoicings. I could see that she was enjoying herself. I could see she was almost growing herself just from really expressing positive qualities. And it was a lovely exchange. And actually I realised afterwards that she's been doing some things for me recently, and I'd been rejoicing in her qualities quite a bit here and there. In a way, I realised, oh, I think it's sort of just getting into a really positive habit for us doing that together. And it made me think how, if a few people start doing that, a couple of friends start just appreciating each other, not like, oh, you're great, oh, yeah, you're lovely, much more specific than that. actually it becomes a positive habit that you all benefit from. You're learning about qualities, you're learning about what happens when you express positivity in the world, what effect it has, and it's quite profound, I think. So that's our fifth stage, which we looked at last week, and those of you who are here, I sent you off to, we had a practice here in the class, and then sent you off to have a practice out there in the world. So then we come to our sixth stage, which I'm going to go on to now. But just to sort of end our day. So we started off our day with remembering our values, affirming our values. Then we went off into our day and had to keep recommitting ourselves to our direction because we forget. We forget where we're trying to go. And then we practice the precepts. We were looking at our behaviours, our positive behaviours, looking at our negative behaviours, and some confessing, but also seeing the positivity in others. So all that could happen in a space of a day. And then at the end of the day, one reflects. So how was that? How was my day? What did I learn from my day? What do I need to learn? What did I see... What did I see about myself that I need to understand more? That brings you to where we are now, which is the sixth stage in this puja, which is called entreaty and supplication. I'm talking about a day, but also I'd like to just remind ourselves that we can these things. Because I said the puja, these seven stages, are how a spiritually advanced person, how they naturally express themselves. They don't have to think about it like we do. They don't have to remind themselves. They're just naturally like that. For us, it's a practice. And for us, if you're practicing over a period of time, you might also notice that some phases of your life, some of these moods, qualities predominate. They can all be there, but for example, you know, you might be, if you decide, actually, I'm a Buddhist and I really want to see what difference being a Buddhist makes in my life, you really might focus on the precepts and ethical practice, and that might be really at the forefront of your mind for some time. You know, for me at the moment, one of the things that are at the forefront of my mind is rejoicings. You know, I sort of get the chance to work here. I see lots and lots of positive qualities and skills. So I'm really enjoying and practicing rejoicing, and I'm noticing it in the way others interact as well. So sometimes there's a period of your life where phase will predominate more than others. So we get to the entreaty and supplication. And in this stage, entreaty really means humble or earnest request. Humble or earnest request. It can also mean prayer. It can also mean a cry from the heart. So if you think about that, we've come to the end of our day, we've had all kinds of experiences, all kinds of interactions, we're reflecting on our experience, and we recognise there's further for us to go. We sort of see the limits of our understanding. And sometimes that limit of our understanding causes us some pain. It's like, if only we understood more, if only we could change this particular sort of behavior. It can cause us pain, it's not a negative pain, it's more like this cry from the heart. It's more like the real desire to know and do better. So this entreaty and supplication is where you really are reflecting and asking for teachings. You're asking for truth, really, to come into your life and vivify your life even more, to energize your life even more. And it's just in the puja, it's just two verses, quite simple verses. The first one is saying to the Buddhas, may you shine the Dharma, may you shine the lamp of the Dharma. And the second one is saying to the spiritually advanced beings who are really gearing towards freedom for themselves and others, they're really saying, look, stay in the world, stay in the world, because the world really needs your understanding. It needs your level of commitment and your dedication. So Bhante, the teacher, the founder of this centre, says that this episode, this entreaty and supplication, goes right back to the Buddha's time and to the Buddha's life. So you may know that the Buddha-to-be, before he became a Buddha, was really desperately seeking truth. And he tried all kinds of different avenues. You know, he really excelled in meditation. He knew how to take his mind to highest levels of consciousness. However, he realized actually meditation itself wasn't enough. He knew how to practice ethics as well. He was an ethical being by that time, but he knew just being good wasn't enough. He also practiced asceticism, whereby he tried to, it's like mind over matter. If I can subdue my body with my mind, I'll be able to control my experience. I'll be able to control my emotions. And he realized that didn't work either. So he was trying all these different ways to find the truth. And then finally, he discovered what we call the middle way, the way between extremes, the way between pleasure for pleasure's sake and pain, and the way between lots of other extremes and opposites. And he sat down under the tree and was ready to, he knew the way forward to gain enlightenment. So he becomes enlightened after a very dramatic, many experiences. He becomes enlightened and he spends the first 7 days gazing at a tree afterwards. He just gazes at the tree that sheltered him. And they say he glazed unblinkingly for 7 days. And really what that was he was really, had huge amounts of gratitude to the tree. The tree had sheltered him. It was one of the conditions that helped him, attain enlightenment. So he has a lot of gratitude to the tree. And then after some more time, he realizes, well, he's gained enlightenment, he's broken through, he's uprooted completely the greed, hatred, and ignorance. He's completely uprooted them. He has obtained freedom. And he wants to share it. It's sort of a natural thing, isn't it? If you discover something that you really like, but you really think is really valuable, you want to share it. So he had this momentum to share it. But then he has this doubt come into his mind, or a question, let's say. And this question is, this experience that he's had has been so profound, so earth-shattering, so life-changing, so radical, will anyone really be able to understand it? Will they be prepared to go on the journey to discover it? He's really not sure at this point. This is how the legend goes. It's so profound, so deep, so exultant that are we prepared? Are ordinary people caught up in our day-to-day lives, caught up in earning a living, raising a family, work, all the things that we do, are we really able to really go on that journey? Go on the journey of really understanding the heart and mind. So he has this doubt, this question. But then, the story says, a being appeared, this being of light appeared, called Brahma Sahampati. And Brahma Sahampati is like a godlike figure. But in Buddhism, a god isn't the higher being, because in a way, you actually can think of people that seemingly lives kind of really easy, heavenly lives. Sort of things seem to go really easy for them. We say, well, they're living like godlike lives in a way. But it ends. Everything comes to an end. And even for this godlike being, this being of light, that will come to an end as well. So Brahma Sahampati appears, and he knows that the Buddha has this question. And he says to the Buddha, there are beings. Yes. This truth, what you've discovered, is profound, is challenging, but there are beings with but little dust in their eyes. That's how he expresses it, but with little dust in their eyes. I.e. there's some people who want the truth, who are ready for it. So at this point, the Buddha has this vision of humanity. He sees the whole of humanity in all its different states. So if you can imagine, I sometimes get a glimpse of some aspects of humanity when I open the newspaper. Not that I open newspapers these days, it's online. When I sort of read the news online, you get a sort of a a glimpse of some aspects of humanity, you know, businesses doing really well and celebrities and, famines and earthquakes. You know, you get this whole sense of the complexity of life and all these beings caught up in all the various dramas that happen, that play out on our screens. So you can imagine the Buddha has this vast sense of the whole humanity at that point. And then this image of humanity turns into a vision of lotuses in a lake. So lotuses are amazing flowers, which are, their roots are really firmly in the mud, and they have these really large petals that open up. But as he has his vision, he sees that there all these petals, all these lotuses are at different stages of development. There are some that are pretty much submerged in the mud, that hardly see in the light. And there are others which are buds completely closed. It's up, it's out of the mud, but the buds completely closed. There are others where the buds slightly open, and there are yet others whose petals are facing the sun, and therefore receiving all the light from the sun. So in a way, this brings us to our theme, because this stage is entreaty and supplication. We're asking for a teaching. We're saying we're ready to learn more. We've got to the limits of our current understanding. We recognise that some more understanding, more knowledge, more awareness will make a difference to us. And we're open to that. We're wanting to receive something. And this is what we call receptivity, spiritual receptivity. And Bante says this, Sangharakshita says this. Spiritual receptivity is of the utmost importance. Without it, spiritual progress cannot be maintained. So even if you start your journey and you're all sort of, got lots of gusto and energy, at some point you need more. You need something else. Yes, to take you from where you are to where you next want to be. And then he says, we need to hold ourselves open to the truth as the flower holds itself open to the sun. Just like that vision. And I really like what he says here. He says, we're holding ourselves open to higher spiritual influences that are streaming through the universe, but which we are not usually in contact with, because we shut ourselves off from them. So spiritual influence is streaming through the universe. That's a lovely image, I think, because we think we have to do a lot of striving. And in a way, we sort of do. Our first few stages of this puja, where we're working on our practice, our ethics, and we're trying to hold our values and vision in mind, it takes quite a lot of effort, actually, to do that. And at a certain stage, what we need to do is, it's not we're relaxing our efforts, but we're going into a slightly different mode, which is receiving. We're receiving the positive influences that are already there. But where are they? Where are these influences? Well, Buddhism would say they're both, because we can. That's been a way why we have the shrine, where we have teaching, so you could read a teaching. But we know, I'm sure you've had this experience where you can read a teaching or listen to a talk, and sometimes it sort of like just goes over your head. You're like, what did they say? And other times, there'll be something that was said that you'll be like, it's like earth shattering. You think, I need to remember that. Yeah. And in a way, it's not sometimes it's the teaching, but actually more often it's us. It's more often about how receptive, how open we are to taking something new. So basically, the Buddha has this vision of people at all different stages of their development. So we're all at different stages of our development, but also in the course of a day or a course of a year, we can also be at different stages of openness. You know, sometimes we're very open, we really want to know, and other times we actually feel ourselves, we're shut off, yeah? We don't want to know. Yeah, they've got nothing. Nobody's got anything to teach us. Yeah. What also is interesting about this episode is that the Buddha is clear that no matter how the Buddha is fully enlightened at this point, but he can't make anyone change. Yeah, that really is up to us. That's really clear, and that's in a way that's what this episode's about. The Buddha can't make anyone change, but what Brahma Sahampati is saying to him is, like, you don't have to do that, clearly. What you do have to do, what you can do, is enter communication with others. And then it's up to them, whoever you enter into communication with, to whether they receive what you've got to say or not. So anyway, the Buddha goes off. He goes off and he knows who he wants to find. He knows who he wants to teach. Because before he became enlightened, he was working with these five friends, and they were all doing this ascetic practices. In fact, I don't know if you've been looking the news recently. There's a big Hindu festival happening in India right now. I don't know the name of it. Does anyone know the name of it? Yeah, it's huge. It's like, I don't know. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's this huge festival, and you get in this festival all kinds of practitioners, and you often see there's lots of naked ascetics. Their hair's matted down to the floor, and they're naked, and they're in the Ganges, and they're purifying themselves, and so it's a very alive practice. It's people still practicing this way. So the Buddha knows he's going to go to his ascetic friends, and because he knows now that they were on the wrong path, they weren't going to find truth by denying their bodies. He knows that. At the same time, he also knows how committed they are to discovering the truth. So he goes to them, and when he goes to them, they don't want to you know, meet him, see him, because as far as they're concerned, he's a slacker. You know, he ate food, he's kind of enjoying himself, meditating now, he's not really, you know, doing the hard work. So they don't want to greet him. But then because he's freshly enlightened, they can't resist his energy. His energy is so vibrant, so alive, that they feel just naturally moved to greet him. So they do, and they give him a seat, and then he tells them his experience. And not only tells them his experience, they engage in what really is a workshop, because by this time he's encouraging them to all to eat. You're going to need your strength. So he's encouraging them to eat. And they're really engaging deeply in the teachings. And sometimes one of them goes off, collects food for all the others to have, and they carry on the teaching. And then finally, one man, Kondinya, realizes the truth. And the Buddha knows that he's seen the truth. He's uprooted his greed. He's uprooted his hatred. He's discovered this radiant heart, this mind that's infinite. And the Buddha says, Kondinya knows, Kondinya knows. And it's this really joyous occasion. And Kondinya's the first one because he's done the groundwork and he's also the most receptive. But then obviously all the others then become enlightened as well. So we know that the Buddha's, in fact, it's a really significant moment, because it's then that we can see that actually it's possible to transmit, it's possible to share the enlightenment experience to someone who's not enlightened and for them to realize it for themselves. And that's why Buddhism's still alive today. But then, so we know about that story, and that's quite a well-known story about the Buddha going to his five ascetics. What's not so well-known is where the Buddha, one of the first people the Buddha meets is a man, before he meets his five friends, is a man called Upaka. And in fact, Upaka sort of sees him on the street and sees this being who's clearly, something's happened. He feels the energy of the Buddha. And he's a naked ascetic, so he's got this matted hair. That's his practice. But he sees this being, he knows this being is engaged in spiritual practice. He can just feel it. So he goes over to him and he says, what's your practice? What's your practice and who's your teacher? And the Buddha says, I'm gonna say what the Buddha says. He says, I have no teacher. No one exists like me anywhere in all existence, and I have no peers. I am the supreme teacher, and I alone am fully enlightened. I am now travelling to set turn in the wheel of the Dharma for a world that has grown blind. So Upaka says, oh, So you're victorious then, are you? And the Buddha says, yes, I am the victor. And he goes, oh, may it be. Sorry. He says, may it be, friend, may it be. Which kind of to me means, if you say so. And then he walks off. He walks off. And he's quite, the text says, he's quite careful not to go down the same road that the Buddha's gone down. So that's really interesting, isn't it? That Kupaka really, he's curious, but he really doesn't really want to know really much about the Buddha. He really is not that interested. He's not open to learning. He thinks he knows the way to his truth, and that's where he's going to go. So we've got two examples there of someone who's, well, the group of five who are really open, they really want to know, they're really dedicated. And we've got an example of someone who's like curious, but is not going to go any further than that. And that's partly he was invested somewhere else, but also if you think about us, sometimes that we do think we know who we are. We think we know who we are, we think we know what our mind is, we think we know who other people are. We have quite fixed boxes in which we view ourselves and other people. And we have lots of judgments as well. And when we have that, it's actually very difficult to receive something new at that point. It's very difficult to receive a teaching. So one of the things we have to do is just to let go of who we think we are. Let go of even who we think we are as a meditator. Sometimes we have to do that when we sit down to meditate. We think, oh, I'm a very good meditator, I'm going to have a really good meditation, or I'm a terrible meditator, I'm going to get distracted. Let both of them go and just be open to the experience that arises. That's one of the things we have to do. There's another story about the Zen master who, there's a professor that went to the Zen master and said, okay, teach me, I want to learn, teach me. And the Zen master, what he does, he says, oh, let's have a cup of tea. And he pours the tea into a cup, and the cup's filling, and the Zen master continues to pour till the tea's overspilling, and he continues to pour. And then the professor's getting really annoyed, like, what are you doing? It's just spilling everywhere. The teacher says, I say what he says. He says, well, you're like this cup. You're so full, nothing can be added. We say that, don't we? We say people are full of themselves. and it's kind of like, it's full of themselves in the wrong kind of way, isn't it? It's sort of like, it's like the ideas. We can have an inflated sense of who we are, or we can have a deflated sense of who we are. Either way, we're limiting our perspective. Either way, we need to let go of who we think and be open to teachings, be open to the truth. So that's a part of practice. So we've done all this sort of in the puja, we've done all this working on our minds, we're meditating, we're working on ethics, we're getting to know ourselves, and then there's a process of letting go so that we can receive something new, so the teachings can actually touch our hearts and change us. But there's something that stops us from doing that, another thing, is fear. Because actually because we think we know who we are, we're also comfortable in that. And teachings, when you take a teaching in, it sort of implies that you're going to change. And we don't always want to change. We sort of say we want to change, but actually the process of change can feel uncomfortable because it's new. We start finding ourselves acting a bit differently, for example, and it feels new. And that can make us feel a bit nervous or even afraid. So we do need courage. We need courage to look at our minds. We need courage to meditate. We need courage to take a teaching and reflect on it and say, okay, what's the relevance? What's the meaning for me? What if I was going to live this teaching out, what would look different in my life? We need courage to do that. And then you might ask for courage. And that courage comes from within, but it also might come from without as well. So we have on the shrine today a bodhisattva called Green Tara. And Tara is, she's green, a colour of healing, a colour of nature. And she's called, her title, they call her the quintessence of compassion. She's deeply kind, but she's also deeply responsive. So in a way, when we're finding ourselves with those barriers that sort of stop us from making progress, it says, oh no, I don't want to, I'm nervous about change, I don't want to actually go any further, we can remember, well, kindness is important. We can remember the qualities of kindness. We can call that from within ourselves or call that without. In Buddhism, there's no real distinction between within or without, really. And Tara is one of the figures that people will call to because, in a way, she's very responsive and she'll just encourage you to keep going. And she also has this hand up like this, and this is a hand of fearlessness, a gesture of fearlessness. So there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, we're actually encountering our own hearts and minds and getting to know who we are. And that actually is getting to know not just the clouds that might obscure our vision, but actually what lays beneath the clouds, what lies above the clouds, which is this sort of radiant heart and open mind. So we can, when we entreat, we're calling for teachings, but we're also calling for assistance, if you like, whether that comes from within or without, we're calling for that courage, that encouragement to keep going, to keep going further into our journey. So we're going to have some mantras now. One of the ways you can practice this receptivity in your everyday life is actually to do nothing. To sit and for 5-10 minutes is actually just do nothing and receive whatever's going on in your experience. This is what we were doing earlier, and Dave and Mitch was encouraging us to take in our experience. Often we're trying to avoid our experience. So to sit and do nothing actually enables us to do that. So that's one way you can practice this. But you can also practice if there's a teaching, and sometimes it's just a phrase, really reflecting on it and seeing, okay, if I allow this teaching to really sort of enter my sort of being, if I really reflect on it, what would happen? What's the sort of implications of this teaching for me? And just see what arises. See what arises for you. Okay, so let's get into our meditation postures. And Steph will do start us off in the mantra. And if you like, you can come and make an offering as well during that time.